Thin Digital Line, policing in the year 2045.
Hello, I'm Jason Harwin, and welcome to the latest episode of Thin Digital Line. During this series, we'll be exploring how the world of digital, data, and technology will impact on policing by the year 2045. I'm really delighted to be joined on today's episode by, firstly, Temporary Commissioner Peter O'Doherty, who's the National Police Chief's lead for cyber and economic crime. Hello, Peter.
Good to be here, Jason. Thank you.
And Alan Anderson, who is the Executive Director from the award-winning digital transformation company Exception. Hello, Alan.
Hello.
As always, really grateful to you both for giving your valuable time. Today we're going to talk about all the things related to cybercrime, fraud and the implications for policing, not just now, but looking at 2045 as well. To help listeners, Peter, do you want to talk through what you see as the current challenges and opportunities that policing are doing around cyber and economic crime now?
Yeah, sure, Jason. So I think if we look at the increased globalization of goods, people, services, evolution of technology, changes in social norms, the internet is such a massive part of our everyday lives, online shopping, booking holidays, communicating with loved ones. Cybercrime, in my opinion, is the most rapidly evolving threat, both in terms of volume and complexity. And I think there are three lines of threat. First of all, young children looking to explore their ability to disrupt network servers. For QDOS, they do it because they can. They have that kind of mindset. They're digital natives. Secondly, we see a threat from those that we investigate as a form of retaliation. But the biggest threat that's increasing at pace that I am most concerned about is hostile state activity. Now, hostile state threat actors, the ambition is to impact the economic stability of the UK, which they will do through disrupting utility like gas, water, electricity, policing and other critical services. And for policing, responding to that is really difficult, Jason, because as you know, in policing, we're always taught that every crime has three elements. It has an offender, if you think about a homicide or a rape, but an offender, a victim and one physical location. The difficulty around cybercrime is we have an offender, which is normally an unknown entity outside the UK. We have thousands of victims globally, and we have multiple locations. So the very DNA of policing around how we are built to operate is being challenged in every possible way. Because the reality is investigating cybercrime, given its volume and complexity, is very, very difficult, which means we have to change, we have to work in partnership, understand the threat, look forward to prepare for it, disrupt it when it happens, but most importantly, do everything in our power to protect people and to protect business in the first place. To just give you a sense of scale, we see about 30,000 frauds reported to us every 4 weeks, and about 90% is cyber-enabled. So it's really, really challenging. And just as an example, technology has always been a vehicle for crime, but it's now becoming a vehicle for modern warfare. And the best example of this is the invasion of the Ukraine by Russia, which, although that's been happening from a physical point of view for only about 3 years, actually we know that Russia was attacking the digital infrastructure across the Ukraine to destabilize its defenses going back to 2014. And we know that hostile states like Russia, like North Korea, like Iran, they openly have IT armies. These are thousands of people in factories, in warehouses, designing computer viruses every day. And you know what? Some of them are really smart people. So it's a big, big challenge.
I know previously we've spoken before about actually understanding the scale and the underreporting. And again, the reality is this affects everybody, probably every day of the week, really, at the minute. In terms of priorities for policing and your work as the national lead, what are the priorities at the moment you're focused on?
So many. So I will reference what we call the strategic policing requirement, which effectively is a set of priorities that every police force has to respond to. So civil contingencies like flooding, child abuse, public order, but cyber is one of the key strategic policing requirements. So I definitely feel that cyber has become a priority for policing. And we are well rehearsed across policing to mobilise and respond to a cyber attack as and when it happens. But of course, there are other priorities we commit to in policing, particularly violence against women and girls, which sadly is on the increase. County lines, particularly involving young people who are being recruited by gangs all across the UK, who are offered a night in a hotel and a pair of trainers to deliver a package from A to B. Human trafficking continues to be an issue. Small boats and some of the illegal immigration that happens as well. So there is such a plethora of responsibilities. How does policing use the resources it has to provide a service to the public that meets all of those varying priorities whilst achieving public confidence? And if I may, just my last point. So the intelligence suggests that things like terrorism, cybercrime, human trafficking, child abuse, serious issues, not decreasing. When we speak to local communities, we rightly provide a service that's policing by consent in this country. But of course, what many communities want us to focus on are those local visible issues like antisocial behaviour, dog fouling. Now, it doesn't mean that those issues are any less important, because those people seeing that in their communities every day, it's a big problem. But we somehow have to provide a service that is valued by all local communities, that is hitting the priorities we know are serious issues, but also provide a service that addresses the issues that matter to local people. And this is the ongoing complexity and pressure upon local policing.
And you've touched on already about the importance of not just dealing with it as the police, it's that partnership, private, public, and importance to the communities as well. So just in terms of what's changed around the policing response to cybercrime and fraud over the last 10 years, just to give the listeners a bit of a perspective of what's changed in your time as the lead, and there's been significant change through your leadership.
Well, thank you. There are absolutely loads of changes. So, of course, we have invested into more investigators. But if we reflect upon my point earlier, we're not going to, quote, investigate our way out of the problem. So I'll give you some examples of where we have invested our focus. So first of all, on prevention, or as we call in police and protect. So we have established cyber resilience centres all across the UK. This is a policing and private sector partnership where effectively policing and private sector members sit on a cybercrime resilience centre, and there's 10 of them all across the UK. And effectively, they provide cybersecurity training to small businesses and micro businesses who can't afford to buy in private sector expertise. Many of the services we provide are free, and some of them are low cost. So that's one thing we have done. We've also provided digital detection dogs. Now, the British public, Jason, they love a dog story. So we've always had dogs that detect explosives, cash and drugs. Well, we now have dogs trained that we deploy to a cybercrime scene who can sniff out a USB stick that's been plugged into a server. They can sniff out a server that's been compromised with. So we can now deploy dogs to the scene of a cyber incident. We have over 230 crypto tactical advisors in policing. So as you know, money laundering was always through cash or through what we call value transfer, where an organised crime gang would buy a Ferrari using cash. They would drive the Ferrari overseas, sell it, and then take the cash from there. There is a movement towards digital currencies and NFTs as a form of money laundering. So indeed, we need the capability in policing to investigate cases where digital currencies are being used to launder money. So we have the ability now, working with the private sector, to interrogate blockchain to try and follow the money from A to B so we can recover the money and give as much of it back to victims as possible. In policing as well, policing or data held by policing, it has the highest trade value on the dark web. And it's because we hold sensitive information, the names and addresses of paedophiles, victims who have reported crimes. And so policing is a target. So we have done a lot of work around improving the cybersecurity across policing and now have an operation called Delta Alpha 1, which is when policing is attacked by a cyber threat actor, we have a cyber gold commander who chairs a gold group, bringing partners around the table, be that the National Cybercrime Unit, part of the NCA, Home Office and other government partners to help policing respond. And just lastly, we look at new trends and typologies. And through the understanding of those trends and typologies, we convert that into advice we can give to businesses to self-protect. One quick example, the police cyber alarm. This is a piece of software that we have designed with industry. It's free to download. It sits on your firewall of a business and effectively monitors and captures threat information. That information is sent to us centrally. We have a team of analysts who interrogate that information to understand the new trends, the new typologies, the way new threat actors are exploiting technical vulnerabilities. And we convert that into prevention advice that goes out to businesses to say, look, implement A, B and C, and that will protect your infrastructure going forward. So a whole range of public-private initiatives, strong on prevention and strong on disruption.
Yeah, and as you say, a lot of that is hidden. All that work from the police service and the partners is very much hidden, isn't it? And it's important for reassurance of the public they actually understand some of that as well. Let's look outside policing then, Alan. In terms of looking back into policing from outside, what are other sectors doing in terms of the cyber threat?
So the response and the combating a cyber threat requires a holistic approach across these other sectors. Essentially, they're trying to prevent, detect and respond to a lot of things that really means that the police have got less of a job to do. So they are making the obvious investments in things like technology, where they're trying to secure their perimeters. They're investing in software that helps them analyse and look at their data. They're looking at who owns the business system and does the business actually work and own it. But all the same time, trying to balance what the customer actually wants from convenience against the safety and security that's needed so that the customer, be it the business or the consumer, doesn't actually lose any money. And generally, it usually comes down to money. There are other types of fraud that can be impacted. You know, there's tech that's involved. There's the overall robustness of the management systems. So being prepared for events that happen, putting in place incident plans, recovery management, involving teams that perhaps weren't used previously. So communications managers, finance managers to understand the impact of it all. And we see these sectors really investing in specialists. Often they would previously employ people from higher education, put them on a graduate scheme. Now they're starting to use them for the skills that they've got, employing them directly as data scientists for their maths capability, for their analysis, and start to develop some models that help them solve the problem that they've got, preventing it. I think the other piece is also wider than other sectors. It's around cultural aspects. It's around training people. So yes, companies train people to help their business run better, but also really as life skills as well. So they understand the threat that is out there and they can help their family, their friends and explain things to them. And some of the organisations are going further, particularly some of the banks providing customer education or providing them with software that helps them stop and prevent. So we see a lot of things, I think, it's in the private sector. I think the other piece is the public sector, where fraud against the state is probably one of the most economically damaging things that we have. I think the investment probably the public sector needs to make in is try to protect, to recover and to disincentivize people to create these activities.
I think it's like you talked on there, Peter, about policing, significant investment, recognising the challenges and the scale of the challenges has gone into it, but must continue. As you touched on there, I think it's fair to say that certainly in terms of the private sector, they realise the risk to their own organisation, but then recognising their social and corporate responsibility to work with other people, including the police service, to address that. I suppose the bit looking ahead, because that's the challenge now. Obviously, we're focusing on the 2045, and I suppose, and accepting it's a long way off, and a lot of people say, how can you think ahead of 12 months, 24 months, let alone 21 years? But what's your thoughts, Peter, on how cybercrime and fraud may change over the coming years leading to 2045?
What a question. So in the technology arena, 21 years is indeed a long time. In fact, 5 years is a very long time. Now, if I say to you that at the moment we think there are 25 billion devices connected to the internet, and we think by 2030 there'll be 150 billion devices connected to the internet. We've got quantum computing. We've got AI and automation. We've got some big technology pieces happening at the moment that will absolutely go on to shape the demands that we have from a crime and modern warfare perspective. I'll give you one example, Jason. We saw a crime recently. So for digital currencies, right, in the early days, so back in 2011, 2012, you could earn coin by doing data mining, right? So data mining effectively is using the processing speed of your computer, as it was back then, to effectively do all the transactions on the ledger. To earn coin doing that now, you would have to have so much processing capability. You'd have to have a factory with 5 or 6 floors of CPU farms because it's immense power required. So the crime we saw recently was sitting behind advertising on a website was a malware. And when you went onto the website, the malware was deployed to your smart device. And the malware effectively used and leveraged the processing capability of your smart device to do data mining. So you had a threat actor based overseas that had deployed the malware into tens of thousands of devices worldwide and effectively amalgamated the strength of that processing capability to do data mining to earn money. Now that's in 2021. So if you're asking about 2045, it's huge. And I think that despite the opportunity that AI and quantum computing will bring, there is indeed significant threat. Already we're seeing the use of AI in boiler rooms. So many of the listeners would have seen Wolf on Wall Street, where you've got a contact centre, you phone victims and you falsify the existence of a company, you promise them the world in terms of a return on investment, but they're already using things like ChatGPT and other AI platforms, generative AI platforms, to develop a script that psychologically will leverage the vulnerabilities of the person you are speaking to based upon where they are, their demographics, how old they are, their profession, family members, to achieve their trust very early on in that conversation to maximise the probability that they're going to invest in this fake company. So they're already using that now in 2024. And of course, what I worry about when I think about the next 21 years, when AI is a common feature of day-to-day lives, healthcare, education, and it offers so many opportunities around deep fakes, impersonalization, the ability to use learning to leverage the psyche of a victim to achieve criminality. These are the things I'm worried about. It also will offer a massive advantage to hostile state threat actors. But remember, the counter argument is this, that despite the capability that will be on offer to criminals and hostile states, it means we also have good capability around defensiveness. But what we must do is look forward, which is what you're doing in this podcast, and think about 21 years from now so we can put the provisions in place now for protection and defence. Because I have to say, although in law enforcement we're doing some good work, I always feel that we are always trying to catch up and we're not looking long term enough.
So in terms of that look forward enough, and again, recognising it's not just a policing issue, it's a wider societal issue, is there things you're thinking at the minute we're not doing that we should be doing? And that's around capacity in the system, really, to do that.
I think there's a few things we should be doing more of. The first thing is security by design. To be fair, the big tech companies are doing more than ever before around protecting the consumer. And there is actually legislation going through Parliament that will effectively penalise the tech sector for not gripping prevention, like the Online Harms Bill, for example. However, any time a new product is launched into the market, I think there should be quite strong regulation about, well, if that product is going to get launched into the market, what have you done to map and predict all the threat vulnerabilities? What have you put in place to protect the consumer and the users of that product? So I think a bit more pressure on the tech sector is definitely the first thing. The second thing is offensiveness. So I truly believe that we can't just react anymore and we have to be more offensive. And what that means is that government, UK law enforcement and industry actually looking up and out and deploying its own capability to disrupt cyber threats before they even reach the UK. So I think an offensive position is another thing we need. The other thing is better education for young people. So we have a prevent program in cyber. So one example, 4 years ago, young boy, 15 years of age, in his high school, preparing for his GCSEs, he hacked the server in his school and got answers to the questions. We intervened and got him an apprenticeship with the tech sector, and he's now flourishing and doing really well. How do we do that at scale? Because lots of young people, the evidence shows, they actually get into cybercrime through gaming. So if they want to be the first person that completes Grand Theft Auto 5 or Call of Duty, they learn to hack so that they can be the first person to achieve level 4, level 5 and have that kudos on the clear web or dark web. So how do we scale up our efforts to identify those early warning signals, those behaviours that then triggers an intervention at scale to disrupt that? We've done that quite well in the predatory sex offences arena, certainly the FBI back in the 50s and 60s. And I think we should do more of that in cyber. And I think my last point, Jason, would be, again, that horizon scanning, not thinking 5 years' time, 10 years' time, 20, 30, 40 years' time, and thinking about what do we need to start building in terms of infrastructure and skills in the UK and start putting that into place now so that we have our own cyber defensive army in the future that has the resourcing, the know-how and the skills to fight back effectively.
So you touch on a couple of really important points again, the prevention piece and that environmental scanning, that look ahead, isn't it? So certainly from my side, Ellen, that's where the private sector and the public come into play a little bit, because let's be honest, a lot of policing demands, whether it be reactive, proactive, is driven by what's happening outside policing. Have you got some thoughts around the prevention piece, or what more the private sector could do around prevention and, again, helping reduce the risk to individuals?
I think with the private sector, it's actually also the public sector. I agree with the points Peter made there around some of its training and education, and actually it's getting kids at school and their parents and their friends to actually understand societally this is a bad thing to be doing. This is not helping the general society to go. So I think it's not just about what the private sector does, but it's about how the public sector, in terms of education, teaching, starts to influence and make them use their skills for a positive way, in the same way that Peter's outlined. In terms of looking to 2045, you could list a whole number of technologies that may or may not arise, long way away. But the reality is, since the beginning, every technology that's been introduced for some good has also been used for some bad. And you go all the way back to the wheel before there was electronics and digital, things like that. So I think the piece around the company's responsibility to make sure they test, but it's not just the systems, it's the actual processes that they have. You know, I believe we know many criminals will use kind of ambient fraud where they keep testing processes just to find the vulnerability. And I think the private sector and the public sector needs to continually test, develop and evolve its own processes and procedures so that it finds the vulnerabilities first and stop things happening. I think the responsibility of the wider private sector is try to prevent them. I think in terms of supporting, I say the police, but it's more society, I think. It is using the technology and understanding how it can be used in a bad way and kind of designing it with security and with that in mind as well. So I think there are many things that come together wider than just technology, around the people, around the process and around working together across many aspects.
And I suppose the important point is recognising just the private sector tech prevention just as important it does in terms of generating profits, etc., etc. What's your thoughts on that, Alan?
Well, that tends to drive the innovation, because generally private sector is not going to do anything that's not going to make money. And whether it's making money or it's stopping people losing money, that in many ways is a big incentive. I think the piece around, let's say, offensive capability that Peter has mentioned, I'm sure there are things going on in many of the high-tech companies that are looking at how they can use that and deploy that, and perhaps it is working with the public sector to say, what body could we have to use that? Because it's probably not a policing body, because it's a separate type of activity. It's, as you say, it's an offensive activity. So I think there are ways that the private sector will come to the party when it sees there's money to be made and innovation that can be deployed.
Yeah. And I suppose going back to the point you said there about technology, artificial intelligence, machine learning could be used for good. But as we talk about in another episode, it can be used for bad as well. And the challenge for policing, Peter, is policing is ruled by rules. There's certain ways it can be applied and not. So in terms of looking ahead, some of the legal challenges, and let's be honest, one of the key challenges is around that increased security versus privacy, the right to privacy. What's your thoughts on that?
It's so difficult. There is this ongoing friction between data privacy and prevention. So, for example, what about a world where if you have a social media account, or you sign up to a marketplace, you have to provide an address or verification of address and a digital ID. And that's been a real hot topic around IDs in this country. But what about if you had to provide a copy of your driving license or passport for every social media account or every marketplace? Now, that would certainly prevent a lot of crime, but now you've got an issue around trust and data privacy. And I don't think we have found the balance as effectively as we might, first of all. The second bit, I think, is, yeah, there are threats we're worried about. I mean, you know, driverless cars, for example. Could you imagine an attack on the infrastructure used within driverless cars? And I mean, that's a public health issue. And so my view would be there should be pressure on those companies to make sure that they are testing that. And I also think as well that you've got environments like the metaverse, where we're already seeing crime taking place in the metaverse. We also think that by 2026 or 7, that everyone under the age of 25 will spend at least an hour of their day in the metaverse. Well, who's regulating that? If you want to be a member of the metaverse and live a life online, what form of ID do you have to provide? What reassurance does anyone have that the person is who they say they are, etc., etc.? So there's a bit around identification, verification, and penalisation when that isn't followed. And I think the Internet of Things. So imagine a world where, you know, you can do it now. You can control the fridge from an app, from your smart device, a driverless car. You can ask a bot to book you a family holiday. Here are your parameters. Yeah. Great. You know, luxury, efficiency. Wow, I'm excited for my own son who's going to enjoy that. But each of those opportunities brings an opportunity for the same technology to provide a false holiday or to offer your bank details, or for someone to use technology to copy someone else's ID and then you start an account. So the issue is, it's how do you mismatch that benefit with the risk of making it worse for people? I think it's really challenging and there is work to be done.
And clearly some of that conversation has got to be with the public, isn't it?
So absolutely.
Both from prevention, about, as you touched on there, and about working with the public to understand the risk. Again, not necessarily causing alarm, but being more alert to the issues that's actually taking place. But just importantly, like you say there, it's about recognising there is ways to prevent this and prevent more future victims as well. And it's that balance, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that certainly in policing, we need to be better at using young people to help us with this, because there is a view that age knows best, and certainly within cyber it does not. And I once heard, you know, the guy from Catch Me If You Can, Frank Abagnale, I once heard him do a presentation, and he spoke about when he was convicted by the FBI and they then gave him a suspended sentence, I think it was, and used him to help them build their own counter fraud capabilities. And through his work alone, they've gone on to stop loads of frauds. So from a cyber perspective, actually, kids who are now 4, 5, or 10, they're the ones in 10 years' time are going to be immersed in this technology. And they're the ones that we need to listen to around, okay, what could we be doing to prevent this, to disrupt it, and actually bring those young people into policing to help us build that defensive capability. And I have to say, they probably have the best answer around what they think is going to come in 2045, because they're going to be our age at that point and they'll be living that existence. So there's something around us having a more open mind, engaging more with young people to look to the future, because age doesn't know best in this area.
And again, like we've spoken on previous episodes, and young people of today are our future police leaders, sector leaders and everything else, aren't they?
Yeah.
Do you think it should be mandatory more in schools, this conversation as well?
I absolutely believe it should. There is a debate that I possibly couldn't comment on around the education system, and is it equipping young people with the skills they need to meet the future challenges of modern society, such as how to make good investments, mortgages, etc., etc. But regardless, yes, I think cybersecurity, it is taught ad hoc in school, but unless you're doing computer science or you're doing a degree in cyber, you're not really going to get any form of training. So yes, I think it should be part of the curriculum. It is essential, not a nice to have. And I think through that learning, you may have more young people wanting to work in cybersecurity, wanting to help and make a difference. And also those that may not want to pursue a life of crime if they know the UK government is taking it seriously in the way it is.
And a question I've asked for other colleagues on other episodes around, should the public be worried about the threat from cybercrime, economic crime? What's your thoughts on that?
So the good news is that a majority of the cybercrime impacting consumers could be prevented if consumers took precautions online. Little things like using proper antivirus software, making sure that if they're using their bank card to pay, they're looking out for HTTPS, and if they're unsure, use your credit card with more safeguards. All of that stuff will actually help prevent this. Romance fraud is a great example. And the more we can do to educate consumers to protect themselves, that will eradicate a significant amount of the threat. So I have to say, I'm more worried, and perhaps the public should be more worried about modern warfare, hostile states impacting UK. Now, that's not really impacting UK consumers per se. It's as you said, Alan, before, impacting more infrastructure utility. Now, the World Economic Forum, they're allegedly the only institution that once predicted the pandemic. I think Bill Gates is a trustee. On their homepage 6 months ago, it says the following. It might not be there at the moment, but it did say 6 months ago, and I know because I checked. An international cyber catastrophe is highly likely. It will happen at some point where our core utility, our core infrastructure cannot operate. So I don't think people need to be worried, but they need to be aware. They need to make sure they're in receipt of all the right prevention advice. They need to know where to go in to report it, and hopefully can be reassured by all the good work we're doing to counter the threat. But yes, it is a serious problem. People just need to be aware and protect themselves.
And I know from my past, the local resilience forums, it's on their risk register, one of the top five priorities nationally around the risk assessment as well. So it is one of those, like, so you've got to be aware, and the things that individuals can do, organisations can do to reduce the risk to those as well, isn't there? Alan, again, just looking back into policing, where do you see the private sector? Again, we've touched on some of the things they're doing. Is there anything else that the private sector and other partners, and clearly we've talked about the public as well, but could actually be helping policing in terms of expertise and learning?
I think the private sector and public sector bodies can't expect the police to investigate and resolve all cybercrime-related activities. They just don't have the capacity, and I don't think they have the expertise and knowledge in these certain areas. So I think particularly organisations, which is a general term, they understand their processes, their procedures. They need to be able to detect, probably do the initial investigation to find out if there is a problem, and in essence, package up a case file, for want of a better description, and go to the police and go, I think there's been a problem here. Can you come and do the necessary parts of law enforcement to resolve that? Because they have the expertise of their own business. They have their own expertise of the software that they use, of the processes. They have the vetting of the people that have gone through and operated and used the systems. So they're better placed to pull all that information together. So I think it is that partnership there in terms of trying to prevent and then resolve issues that arise that's a key component of it. I think it works, that partnership piece. And then as you take it further along the lines, I think it is for the prosecutors to be able to find people guilty of the crimes and for remedy to be sought. Because again, I think the public and corporate companies expect the police to find the remedy for it. I don't believe it's the police's job. So there's a wider communication aspect that would need to go out there that says there are other ways. Once the prosecution's been done, if you want remedy and try and recover the money, this is the route that you go through. And I don't think that's well enough understood. You know, it would help the police, it would help society. And it really embeds in people the responsibility that they need to know around cybercrime responsibilities, how to resolve it. And it becomes part of their day-to-day life in the same way that locking the front door does when they leave or crossing the road safely is. And that comes back, I think, to the teaching from a young age as it builds up through people's life.
Jason, can I just quickly say, it's a really good point from Alan, and it makes me think that what we need from industry isn't always complex. So some of the basic needs, for example, the use of automation and AI for disclosure. So can you imagine in a cybercrime investigation or a fraud investigation, multiple devices, terabytes of data, and the complexity of scheduling all of that material? Now, the only way to solve the disclosure issue is through AI. What about redaction of material and files going through CPS? What about firearms licensing, so end-to-end file-out processes? What about chatbots in control room? Actually, that basic functionality using tech that already exists at scale will achieve a significant amount of efficiencies across policing, so we can use the extra headspace and people space to focus on the more complex stuff around hostile states, yeah, cybercrime prevention. So actually, those fundamentals is where industry could probably help us the most.
Again, it's a really interesting point, isn't it? There is current capability now that will help us for the future as well. And it's, again, getting that consistency across not just policing, but the system itself, isn't it, Peter?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm very conscious of time. I know our time's nearly up for today. So before we go, one we've had with our colleagues around fact or fiction 2045, what crime may look like and may not look like. So first one for yourself, Peter, cashless society, will there be cash?
No. I think there'll still be commodity,
yep,
like gold,
yep,
silver, raw materials. But I think we're absolutely, by 2045, we'll be cashless.
Yep.
In fact, I think it'll be sooner.
Okay. Alan?
I'd agree. I think the demographics of life will move it forward that way, as Peter says. You know, yeah, younger and younger people operate and live their life differently. Us oldos will be long gone, and people won't know how to use cash, and it'll be cash.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, again, we'll hopefully be around in 2045. Might not be doing the same roles, but we'll be able to see if that's happened or not. One you touched on earlier on, Peter, I'm going to come to it because, again, one of your colleagues touched on it in one of the first episodes, was around RoboCop, but he talked about RoboDog. So you talked about identification. Do you think there'd be RoboDog by then?
Yeah. Tech already exists.
Yeah.
It will be much more affordable in the next 20 years. Big efficiencies for policing. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Alan?
I was thinking of trade movies with you when I thought about this, and I think where we try to, with cybercrime, it's maybe more Minority Report, where we're trying to identify and prevent things from happening, or also things like the Fear Index, where we're trying to understand where, from a crime point of view, technology, computers can make decisions and make trades such that ends us in a place that we don't really know the consequences of. I'm not sure about RoboCop, but I think another couple of films that we could consider.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see, won't we? All being well, we'll see. So firstly, as always, a massive thank you to you both for your time. Thank you for your insights. Again, we could actually spend a full day just talking about this issue. But again, it gives us a good flavour of some of the challenges at the moment, Peter, you touched on. But importantly, recognising again, it needs a system response. The public have got a really important part to play. They could play that part now to prepare for 2045, couldn't they? And importantly, it's not about the public being alarmed. It's being aware and doing the basics, really. As always, a big thank you to Exception for sponsoring this series. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast service or via the website. In the coming episodes, we'll be going into the importance and opportunities from data for policing, again, looking at 2045. And importantly, what is going to be the future impact on the workforce? How will that look differently? And again, the talks about now how the police service has changed over the last 10 years dealing with cybercrime and open crime. So until next time, thanks for listening.
Finn Digital Line. Policing in the year 2045.